It's basketball season, and today on KPR Presents, we get in the mood for the NCAA tournament with a new documentary on one of basketball's forgotten heroes. I'm Kay McIntyre. Fast Break traces the life and legacy of basketball coach John McLendon and will air on KCPT Monday, March 13th, Thursday, March 16th, and Saturday, March 18th. It's directed by Kevin Wilmot, who teaches film and media studies at the University of Kansas. Always great to see you, Kevin.
Yeah, great to see you, Kay.
McLendon's story starts in Hiawatha, Kansas, in the year 1915. Tell me about his early years and how he came to basketball.
Well, his family's a very much a Kansas story, a very interesting story in that sense. His family are part of the Exodusters, you know, the Exodusters that came from the South. You know, a lot of them came from Kentucky, areas like that, Tennessee, and they come up to Kansas to come to the Free State. You know, Kansas had this reputation of John Brown and the Free State, and so they were called the Exodusters. So his family's a part of that, and so they end up in Hiawatha. And he's he's got a strong family, his mother in particular is a really strong figure in his life, and they moved to Kansas City eventually, and he gets to see a basketball game in Kansas City at the high school there, and it's not so much a game, but he sees a guy playing ball and he's just taken by this whole thing, and he's just like, wow. And he sees this guy making baskets, and he decides right then and there, I want to be a coach. I mean, he's a kid, but he says, I want to be a coach, and I want to be involved with sports. I want to be like a physical education teacher. So he goes home and he tells his mom, I've decided what I want to be. I want to be a coach and a phys ed teacher. And his mother says, oh, no, you're not. there's no way you're gonna be a doctor or a lawyer or a teacher, but you're not gonna do, this is a game. It's just like a place with a ball. It's not a real thing. So to the very end, his mother didn't like, even after his huge success, she never didn't like it very much. But it was really great because he knew from early on what he wanted to be, and so he goes to the University of Kansas because of that.
Interesting that from the beginning he wanted to be a coach rather than a player.
Yeah. Yeah, he's not a real big guy. And I don't know if he kind of realized that early on. I mean, he did play, but I don't think he was real great. But he kind of figured out early on that I think the real thing was to coach, for him anyway.
So he was at KCK Junior College in Kansas City for a year and then came to the University of Kansas. At the time of legendary James Naismith, the inventor of basketball, what was his experience at KU like?
Well, this is in the 30s. And so Lawrence is segregated. KU is segregated. And he has a teacher, a professor that says a racist joke in class, But his father had sent him specifically. I mean, his father said the guy that created the game is right down the road. And Lawrence, and so he comes specifically because of Naismith. I mean, Naismith is the reason he comes to KU. So he goes to see Naismith, and Naismith is his advisor. And Naismith was a great man. I mean, I don't think he gets the credit that he should in terms of, he was the only losing coach at KU, but he was the coach that I think really, the reason he created basketball was to really kind of mold character and to make young men better. He saw the game as a means to, make Christians and so forth. And so when he goes to, to Naismith and says, this racist teacher just said, he said, that guy has no right to even be teaching in the school. And so he's got an ear he can go to. So these are tough times for blacks in the area because, there's not many people that they can go to really talk about these things. And Naismith was one of those guys. So he goes to Naismith, and at KU at the time, you had to take a phys ed to graduate from the phys ed department. You had to take a swimming test. And McClinton was a great swimmer. He was a lifeguard in Kansas City. So he's looking forward to the test. But they don't let blacks in the pool at Robinson Gym. So it's forbidden for blacks to get in the pool. So they just give you an A. It's like, so instead of getting in the pool, well, you just got an A. Don't worry about it. You know? So he says, no, I want to take the test.
I want to swim.
I'm a great swimmer. I want you to see how good of a swimmer I am. So he jumps in the pool, and they drain it. They drain the pool.
And with him in it?
Well, he gets out, and they immediately drain the pool so that white people don't have to be in the pool where a black person was in the pool. And so, you know, he decides I'm gonna desegregate this pool. So he goes to Naismith and he says, you know, why can't we do this? And at the time, Falk Allen is in charge of it. And he goes to him and says, you know, I want to come swimming here every day. And they called it mixed swimming at that time. So they said, we don't allow mixed swimming. And they said, and if we did, there would probably be trouble. There would probably be some fights, problems. So it's best not to do it. And he said, well, he said, if I come here every day for a week and there's no trouble, will you change the rule? And Falk Allen said, yes, we'll do that. And Naismith was there as his witness. So he goes to all the black students. There's about 70 black students at KU at the time. He pulls them all into a meeting and says, we don't want any problems at the pool. So no problems at the pool. Don't go there until I tell you to come back. So after a week, there's no problems. He comes and he says, there's been no problems, so can we have mixed swimming? And Fall kind of figured it out and said, you kind of worked this, didn't you? You kind of played a trick on me. He said, no. And he said, well, you're kind of a smarty, aren't you? But after that, the pool was integrated at Robinson.
Any other stories about his time at KU that would surprise us?
Well, the other thing Naismith did for him was that he got him a job coaching at Lawrence High School. And at the time, there would be a black team, a black basketball team, and a white basketball team.
The Lawrence Promoters.
Yeah, the Lawrence Promoters. And he got a job coaching the Promoters. And that was a big deal because even though it was a black basketball team, the coaches would often, most of the time, be white. And so a white person would have wanted that job. And it would have been a big deal for a white man to get that job. And Naismith gives it to McClendon because he was the best man for the job. And so that's a big thing. And it really started him out early on the road to coaching, which was a huge gift that Naismith gave him.
Anything else about his relationship with James Naismith?
I think they had a lot in common. They both lost their mothers kind of early, you know. You know, they were both real strong Christians. I think that as a whole, it was that, you know, they both saw the power of the game, you know, outside of just winning and losing, but the power of the game to really be this force for good. I think that was the link that they kind of had. And they were, I think, you know, McClendon really is the best way to understand James Naismith. I mean, he, you know, you always look for characters that kind of reveal who this character is. And, you know, like, you know, you can't understand John Brown without understanding, like, Dangerfield Newby or Shields Green, some of the guys that were killed with him at Harper's Ferry. And when you hear their stories of trying to free their families, you understand why John Brown does what he does. Same thing with Naismith and McClendon. I mean, you understand what's important, what's really important about Naismith by understanding the relationship he had with John McClendon.
Did you learn anything about Falk Allen based on his relationship with John McClendon?
Well, I'd always heard the story about the swimming pool, and so it wasn't really a news story for me. But, you know, Falk, and as I showed this in my film Jayhawkers, I think Falk is a great man on so many different levels. But he wasn't really a progressive. And you know, in the reality of it was there weren't many progressives around, you know, period. I mean, there's just not that many guys that really got it early on. But he wasn't a racist. and he wasn't someone who was trying to hurt anybody. But what Naismith did is that he went out of his way to kind of do the right thing, and in his own way, you know. He wasn't a civil rights pioneer or anything like that, but he did the right thing in his own way, and that should always be honored and remembered.
So John McClendon graduates from KU, and then where does his career take off from there?
Well, he has a friend that is teaching, coaching at the North Carolina School for Negroes. And so he goes there to be like an assistant coach, and he soon gets the job of head coach. And that becomes, you know, his big break. And so he's really taking the things that he'd learned from Naismith, and he's really kind of employing them now. And the thing that he does early on that is the big thing that really changes basketball as a whole is he starts to do the fast break, and he starts to speed the game up. And so the rest of white basketball, and at this time, it's best to look at it as white basketball and black basketball because they're totally separate things. They don't play together. They're two different worlds. You know, and so in black basketball, the game is faster and it moves faster. And it's really because of McClendon that he's the guy that speeds the game up and he creates the fast break. And it's literally, I mean, he will write a book about it. And so the fast break is the whole rhythm of the game now. But it's John McClendon that creates that. And so he's there in North Carolina. And the big story that happens there, of course, is the secret game.
The secret game, 1944. Tell us about that.
So, you know, he is, you know, there's this kind of weird world of the city there, you know, totally segregated. But you know, there are cracks in the segregation a little bit. And whites... Our white Christians are starting to have kind of secret fellowship meetings with black Christians. You know, I mean, this cannot be seen publicly. I mean, it's against the law. You could be arrested or hurt or whatever. And so these are all undercover kind of things for people having fellowship together. And so so this thing gets out about, well, we had a really good basketball team at North Carolina, and these guys affiliate with Duke are saying, well, we got a really good basketball team too. And so eventually it kind of turns into this, well, let's play each other. And so so the Duke team is the Duke Medical School team. It's not the Duke College team. The Duke Medical School team is better than the Duke College team, and they beat them.
Wait, the medical school at Duke University had its own team, and they were better than
the college team, yes. And so these guys are a little older and are almost like a pro team, you know. And again, you know, basketball is still kind of shaping, so it's still kind of here, there, everywhere a little bit. So they have this game with North Carolina School for Negroes where McClendon is, and of course, it's on a Sunday morning, and they did it on a Sunday morning so that no one, the police were at church, everybody's at church, no one's around. Streets are quiet.
Not going to be any trouble here.
Not going to be any trouble. So the team, the North Carolina team comes to, the Duke team comes over to the North Carolina school, and they go into an empty gym. They lock the gym door. You know, no one is allowed in the gym, and they play this game. And so the thing that's you have to really get your head around is that these black players have never even shaken hands with a white person before. I mean, they've never talked to a white man before, not as like, you know, and these are guys their age, but they've never had any kind of interaction at all. And these white men have had interaction with blacks, but on this level of superiority, inferiority. And so there's one guy on the Duke team, and he's a real progressive, great man. And he's the guy that really pushed them to do the game. And he had played on the integrated team before. So he's the guy that really got it, persuaded the Duke team to do it. So they have this game, and Duke is killing the North Carolina school and McClendon's guys. He's just killing them. And so at halftime, the North Carolina school gets together, and then they kind of figure out these guys are just men like us, you know? They were really intimidated by their whiteness, and so they kind of come to terms with these guys just like us, what are we doing? Why are we letting this mess with us like we are? And so the next half, the total thing is flipped, and McClendon's team beats him like by 40 points.
Wow.
And, you know, and it's really great because then they play another game and it's all integrated. It's a shirts and skins game. And so black guys are on the white team, white guys on the black team, and it's all integrated. And so then after that, they go to the dorm, the black dorm, and they hang out for a while and have some sodas and talk. And so this is unheard of. This is unheard of. I mean, in the South, I mean, like I say, if the police had seen them, they would all have been arrested. The black guys probably would have been beaten by the police. I mean, this is really breaking the rules. And so McClendon, you know, the fact that he risked his job, he risked everything to do this. And what he says, well, you know, you just don't pay attention to a stupid law. You just make sure that you're not caught.
But as you said, he did that at tremendous personal risk and professional risk.
I mean, at that same year, a black serviceman coming back from World War II refused to give his seat up on the bus, and he's murdered right there by the bus driver, and he's, you know, not convicted. And, you know, so, I mean, you could be killed.
So what kind of repercussions were there from this secret game? Did people find out about it right
away?
No
one found out about it.
Was it really secret?
It was totally secret. It didn't come out till like 30 years later. It didn't come out until like the 70s that they had this game. It was totally kept secret. Totally, completely kept secret. It's amazing, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah, you know, and I think that probably what happened was that they didn't really understand. After a while, it just became what they did, and they didn't realize the significance themselves. I mean, the players, McClendon, I mean, he went on to do so many other things. He didn't understand how important this was, and it wasn't until the 70s that it was acknowledged and kind of, you know, recognized as this really dramatic, important moment.
I'm visiting with filmmaker Kevin Wilmot. His latest documentary, Fast Break, The Legendary John McClendon, will air on KCPT on Monday, March 13th, Thursday, March 16th, and Saturday, March 18th. Kevin, let's jump forward a little bit. In 1966, McClendon was named coach of Cleveland State University, making him the first African-American coach of a predominantly white university. How was he received there?
Oh, he was great. It was great. I mean, at that point, he was at Tennessee State, the position he had a little earlier, and he'd won three NAIA championships, and that really kind of confirmed that he was a really amazing, great coach, and his reputation. You know, at this point he had been coaching for like 40 years or something almost, and so everyone kind of knew him. And he had this amazing, great reputation. Had never been like kicked out of a game. Had never got into a shouting. Had never lost his temper on the court. You know,
boy, and you can't say that about many coaches.
No, that's given. That's a given today almost. But he never lost his temper. Was always very, very respectful to the players. And again, that's that Naismith thing of this is about something else, not just winning. But he's winning. He's an amazing winning record. And so when he gets to the Cleveland, you know, he's already kind of in many circles acknowledged as this legendary guy. And so he's earned that job, you know, a million times over. And so, you know, and he, what he does is that he, and he did this when he would do the, when he coached for the Olympics as well. That he would have the mixed, you know, the guys would stay in hotels and it would be black and white in one room, black and white in another. So he always made everyone integrate within the group and within the team. And that was, and so that was really his way, I think, of breaking down these barriers. And really, so by the time he gets to Cleveland, he's really ready.
So tell me about his time there and how he did as a coach.
You know, he did well there, but he kind of, you know, every time at this period of his life, you know, he was breaking all these kind of barriers. And so he would then be quickly grabbed and taken to to coach the Olympic team, or and so he quickly kind of moves into the pros right after this. And so, you know, it was his time at Tennessee State specifically that is where he wins these three consecutive championships. That is the thing that really changes the game, because, you know, at this time when he's at Tennessee State, the NCAA is not integrated still. And he's trying to integrate it. He's writing them letters and saying, let us play, let us in the tournament. And they're saying black coaches aren't qualified and so forth. And so, you know, you can't do that. And so he goes to the NAIA, and the NAIA has a guy who's in charge, who's a fellow Kansan. And he's the guy that kind of says, okay, we're gonna give you a chance. And so he goes on and wins three consecutive national championships. And because of his huge success there, the NCAA has to kind of go, okay, I guess we're going to have to let blacks play in the tournament.
Nothing speaks like winning.
And it's amazing, kind of one of the things that you kind of see in sports as a whole is how winning is the thing that breaks down barriers almost more than anything. I mean, it's really insane how the power during this period in the 50s and 60s, when all these, you know, battles in the streets are going on for civil rights, these guys are able to change things in many ways quicker on the court than they are in the streets because of the power of winning.
And in some ways, in a much more quiet way.
Totally. I mean, that was the thing that one of the things that makes him kind of not recognized is that he, you know, he's doing it very quietly, and he's pressuring them in various ways. I mean, you know, he will with the NAIA. He said, "Look, if my team can't come to the tournament was in Kansas City," he said, "if we can't come to Kansas City, my hometown, and stay in any hotel we want to and eat in any restaurant we want to, like everybody else in the tournament, we're not coming." And at that time, they were such a big team that the city, they had the NAI got with the city, and they said, okay, you can stay at the Hotel Kansas Cityan, and you can eat in any restaurant you want. And so that's how those kind of barriers were broken in Kansas City.
I'm assuming that at the time, when they walked into those hotels and when they walked into those restaurants, all eyes were on them, just waiting for something to happen. How much pressure was on him in terms of, like, making sure his team behaves?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's one of the things that's really powerful about McClendon is that, you know, he talked a lot about never wanting to be embarrassed or humiliated in front of his players. And you got to understand, you know, it's like the story about they were on a it was when he was with the North Carolina school, and they were on a train car, and this is in 1941, and they're on a train car, and so but when they would travel, they would have to make provisions. This is where we're going to stay. You can't stay in hotels, so you have to make arrangements with families to stay there. Different things. This is where we're going to eat. This is where we're going to get gas. They'll serve us here at this gas station. So everything is pre-planned to the detail.
And this is, of course, before the internet. So they're making calls and trying to make arrangements.
Yes. And there's this thing called the Green Book that, you know, is kind of a where-to kind of guide to, you know, that black folks kind of use. But in this one case, in 41, they're on this train car, and this is when he's having success, and they've got a train car that's just for his team, that's been set up for his team, and some whites, they stop in the city, and some whites get on the car, and they see this train car is for them, and they just say, "Hey, you guys get out of this car. You guys don't deserve a special car. We want this car. Get out." And of course, this is that thing that McClendon's talking about. We're not wanting to be humiliated in front of his players, and so his player's very disciplined. He's very disciplined. But this is getting really bad. I mean, it's getting to the point where he's probably going to be attacked here at any moment by these guys. And just then, a kid runs down the train car saying, "Pearl Harbor's just been attacked. Pearl Harbor's just been attacked." And of course, that these guys went off with the Pearl Harbor story, and that saved an incident that, he could have been killed, could have went to prison. Who knows what could have happened?
That's an amazing story.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and that same thing, I think, just carries forth in all of these challenges that he has, all these kind of breakthroughs that he has in various ways, like in the Kansas City story with the hotel, those kind of things, that discipline, that kind of, you know, fortitude in terms of we're going to be in control. It's very Dr. King-like in that sense. You know, this is before they understand how Gandhi works or any of those things work. This is just about, like, we're gonna change things by our character and by persevering over ignorance.
McLennan broke yet another color barrier when he went to coach for the Cleveland Pipers.
So again, this is that period where he's kind of, you know, he's moving around a lot and he's not staying any place too long, and he's breaking barriers kind of every step of the way, like he does at Cleveland, then he gets this Pipers job. It's the first pro team. It's a pro team. And the NBA is just developing. It's not even really called the NBA yet. And so, but these are pro teams. And again, you know, another breakthrough. I mean, he's integrated pro team. And so, you know, it gives professionals in the world, he's working for George Steinbrenner. George Steinbrenner owns the team, and we know George Steinbrenner, and of course he's fired not long after that because it's Steinbrenner, but the important thing is that he is breaking barriers with every step of the way, and so now people see a black coach can coach a pro team, you know, a black coach can coach a white university team, a black coach can coach an Olympic team. So that's what's going. So it's like this 10-15 year period where he's moving around a lot, breaking barriers all over the place.
Tell me about his time coaching the Olympic team.
Well, one of the guys on the Olympic team that he did it several years, but one of the guys that we know here is Larry Brown, and Larry Brown has a huge influence on Larry Brown. And one of the things that McLennan did was he really, you know, part of the fast break strategy was everybody was in great shape, and he was really big on conditioning. So Larry Brown talks about how he'd never ran so much in his entire life. And that was a thing that McLennan's teams often did, where they just kind of tired the other team out. And the fast break was a big part of that. And so, Larry Brown is part of McLennan's coaching tree. I mean, he touches, you know, a vast number of people, and he's part of the KU coaching tree, but he has an amazing coaching tree on his own with all the people that he influenced that went on to influence others.
And that coaching that Olympic team, that took the integration that he was doing here in the United States, that took that to an international stage.
Yeah, I mean, because the Olympic thing happens, then now this is when basketball is starting to really stretch its wings and become an international sport. And so he goes to China, he goes to Africa, he goes to Russia, he goes to all over the place, and he's winning there. And there's a really funny story about China when he goes to China, and the Chinese really take to him. And McLennan isn't a big guy, you know, he's a kind of a small man, and he's kind of a brown skinned man, you know, because he's mixed with Native American and black, and so the Chinese kind of see him like he's Chinese, and they kind of really embrace him, and so he becomes a huge celebrity in China. There's big billboards, you know, about John McLennan, and they just love him, and they want him to. So the next year after he coached, they wanted him to come back, but America brings Bobby Knight there. And of course, Bobby Knight, very different personality than John McLennan. So when Coach Knight's, you know, period is finished, the Chinese say, "We don't want Bobby Knight ever to come back again. Bring back John McLennan." I think he was a great ambassador for the game, and kind of broke down a lot of barriers that way as well.
John McLennan retired from coaching in 1969. What did he do after that?
Well, he worked for Converse shoes, and it was really interesting because You know, he would travel around the country and very connected to basketball and games and so forth. And so when he would be at these tournaments, then the Converse would be there and they would have a room for their shoes and, you know, so forth. But all the coaches would come to that room to be with McClendon. And so so Converse kind of became like a way to go bow at the throne of McClendon whenever these tournaments were in, because he had influenced so many people that they would come to these tournaments looking for him and wanting to meet him and so forth. And so he kind of becomes an ambassador for the game in various ways, and he's travels all around the country and the world, really, in various ways promoting the game.
It's hard to imagine after that kind of career that he came to be known as the forgotten coach. How was that possible?
Well, I think that you know, when you think about it in terms of where he starts in the 30s, I mean, basketball doesn't really become a big sport until the 60s, really, you know. And it becomes a really big sport like in the 80s and the 90s almost and the 70s. And so, you know, he's at his peak is not when the mass media has really, you know, connected to basketball. But the other part of it is that he's black. And he's a black coach. And he coached for these black schools in the South. And these black schools are kind of treated unfairly in terms of the attention that he should have been a national figure for the success he had at Tennessee State, but the media didn't focus on that, and they didn't even when he becomes a professional coach and all of those things. I mean, these are big barriers that he's breaking down at the Olympics and other places. And so, you know, when basketball is starting to grow and become a national kind of sport, he's not in that discussion. And people know him, but he's not being honored and he's not being celebrated and his due is not being given to him in many ways. And so it's not really until right before he passes away that he really starts to get the attention he really deserves.
Along those lines, the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame recognized him back in 1979 as a contributor, but didn't come to recognize him as a coach until much later.
Right, this last year, they recognized him as a coach. You know, I mean, he was a contributor, and he, you know, broke all these barriers we're talking about, and, you know, is there at the founding of the game with Naismith and those people. And he's kind of that first generation of coaches that comes out of Naismith, really, you know. And that's an amazing historical fact, you know, and the fact that he's connected to KU and that he comes out of this area. I mean, we should really be honored that we have another great amongst us that did that. But the thing that he did more than anything was win a lot of games and change a lot of social realities for blacks in sports. And so that's the thing that I mean, he is a legendary coach, and he makes his imprint on the game with the fast break that makes it. I mean, he is the modern basketball coach, and he is the example of the modern basketball coach. He brings basketball into the modern world, really. And so the fact that he was now acknowledged as a coach, a little late maybe, but still, it's great that he has those two acknowledgments in the Hall of Fame, that he's there as a contributor and as now as a coach.
Kevin, a little later this hour, we'll hear from some of the speakers at this year's Power of Sport conference at the University of Kansas. How does John McClendon's story demonstrate how sports both A, reflects American society, and B, brings about change in our society?
Well, I think, you know, the great thing about sports is that when that we all play it, and that it's democratic, and that, you know, if you're good, you're going to get to play. And so everybody gets to play. And you know, that wasn't the case with McClendon. And so, you know, the fact that he broke those barriers down and made it more democratic, we take that for granted now. And it's such, when you see sports and you see, you know, black and white people, you know, on the team together, and especially in the 60s and 70s, I think, you know, that the off court activity, the things that were happening in society, the civil rights movement and the different movements that are going on in society, that these things then have a presence on the court. And in that sense, sports has always been more than just the game. You know, that what's at stake in society is always present in the game as well. And you even see that like in the Super Bowl this year, you know, and people were, you know, one team was rooting for another team because of a lot of political things going on in the country right now. And so you can't really divorce society from the game. And in that sense, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. You know, I think that sports, it kind of embodies us as a whole, you know, and that's the thing I've always kind of liked about sports, is that beyond the winning and the losing, there's this other thing at stake, and there's this other thing that's important, and this other thing that embodies the nation, really. And in that sense, I think, you know, McClendon is a great example of that, and how he's able to change things and move things forward, and we all are beneficiaries of that.
How did you get interested in his story?
Well, you know, Milton Katz, who wrote the biography of him breaking through, approached me several years back, and I was fortunate to finally get back to this project and have a chance to be involved, and I'm just really honored to be a part of it.
Many of your other movies are satire. I'm thinking of Chirac, The Confederate States of America. As a filmmaker, what are the challenges of turning your storytelling eye to a documentary form like this?
Well, you know, it's weird because the link between satire and fact, history and fact, because documentaries are facts, is that, you know, satire for me always starts with the facts. And that once you kind of, you've got to kind of know, you know, the reality that you're going to make fun of, and the reality that you're going to kind of expose, and the truth that you're going to try to expose by making it satirical and by kind of exposing it in a certain way, probably because in society people don't always look at it that way. But it always starts with the fact. And so the thing like with Dr. Strangelove, you know, is like it's about taking this fact that these nuclear weapons are all around us. We don't like to think about it. We like to push that part of away from our consciousness, but it's a fact. And so you're trying to find a way to make people come to terms with this fact that we don't really like to think about. Same thing with CSA, with the Confederacy. Same thing with Chirac, with gun violence. You know, so it's a means of taking the facts of things, twisting it, bending it in certain ways to reflect the problems of society. And typically it is the denials of society. It is something that we don't want to come to terms with. And so I always like to say that satire kind of gives people the ability to take ownership of these facts. You know, that because, you know, race is such a difficult part of American life, you know, we just back away from it, and we all suffer it because of that. And so the notion is always to take control, to take ownership of it, to find a way that people feel comfortable in this world of something that's very uncomfortable.
Again, I'm visiting with Kevin Wilmot. He's the director of Fast Break, The Legendary John McClendon. It will air on KCPT on Monday, March 13th, Thursday, March 16th, and Saturday, March 18th. Kevin, thank you so much for coming in today.
Always great, Kay. Thank you.
You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. I'm Kay McIntyre. For the rest of this hour, The Power of Sports, a conversation on race, athletics, and society. The University of Kansas held its third annual symposium on sports and race on February 2, 2017. Next week on KPR Presents, we'll hear the keynote speaker, Dr. Harry Edwards. But today, two of the featured panelists at that conversation, Olympic gold medalist and University of Kansas track star Billy Mills, and KU basketball and WNBA player Tamika Dixon. We'll hear first from Billy Mills, whose 1964 gold medal in the 10,000-meter race was considered one of the greatest Olympic upsets at the time. Mills is the co-founder of the nonprofit organization Running Strong for Native American Youth and is active in advocating for Native American issues.
When I think of racism in sport, I can't help but think of today when the winds of change are blowing, and the winds of change are blowing with a theme: liberty, justice for all, freedom, an opportunity to participate in the marketplace, the free marketplace, and the number one ingredient called for is ownership of property and the American dream, an opportunity to participate in the American dream. But the winds of change are uncovering winds of racism that we have to address. So I'll talk in terms of footprints. One of the ancient stories in the Indian world is we will be known by the footprints we lay on Mother Earth. So I'm going to share some of my footprints, but it's going to be beyond sport, it's going to be beyond Haskell, be beyond KU, beyond Lawrence, because racism is not just an issue of sport. It's an issue we have to address to choreograph the winds of change collectively into the horizon of our future. So I'll quickly go through maybe 5-6 situations of racism, and I'll bring in the University of Kansas. Racism started for me as a young boy on the reservation, playing basketball. I actually could play a little bit of basketball. As we'd go off the reservation to one of the white schools, we always put our uniform underneath our clothing, our winter coats. Boys took a sack lunch. Only years later did I realize we were not allowed to use the showers of the other schools. Well, that still happens throughout America in some communities. I recall when I was at Haskell, going home for the summer months, finding a summer job to buy clothing, found a job building grain elevators, working 6 at night to 6 in the morning. Nobody in the community, Chatham, Nebraska, would rent my friend Benny and I a rooming house, no hotel, no motel, but a very compassionate white farmer simply said, "You two young boys, if you don't give up, you can still work. You can sleep in one of my wrecked cars." So I picked out a Hudson Hornet. But racism was there. I remember at KU. I remember the business community when I was at Haskell inviting me to one of their luncheons, the Kiwanis Rotary. But when I went to KU, I was in a different environment. I remember being stopped by the police at night, coming from a movie, beginning to rain, and searching me and simply telling me, "Haskell is that way," and not believing I was a student at the University of Kansas until they saw my ID. Then they were kind enough to give me a ride out of the rain, take me back to my dorm. But racism is there. The first 3 times I made All-American, twice Collegiate All-American, once USA Track and Field All-American, I'll never get the feelings. I'm asked to get out of the photo. My mentality is my mom and dad are watching from above. I was orphaned as a youngster, and they're seeing I'm making All-American, only to hear, "You. Yeah, you're the darker skinned one." And we all look at our hands. I was the darker skinned one. "I want you out of the photo." The last time it happened, I graduated from KU, an officer in the Marine Corps, and I remember a Marine Corps full colonel grabbing the photographer that said that by his tie, and they don't wear ties now, by the tie, and said, "He's a Marine Corps officer. He will not step out of the photo." And I can fast forward as a United States Marine Corps lieutenant. On my way to Camp Pendleton, the last Marine chosen to train for the Olympic Games, and in New Mexico, going in to check my wife, one daughter, into a hotel, only to be told, "There's no vacancy." But the sign says, "There's no vacancy." going to 5 hotels before I realized I've got to go back to have my wife check us in. She came out and said they have rooms. Racism is there. Racism came close to breaking me. And in a sense, it did. I know what it is to be broken. I'm half white. I'm half Indian. Half of me broke. The other half faced and benefited, if I chose, from a very silent, invisible strength of superiority or privilege. And that conflicted within me, being half white and half Indian, joining one of the most powerful clubs when I moved to California, business clubs. And I'm going to join. It'll help your business. And then having one of the men say, besides, you have qualify. And the winds of change have released that. But what I shared is totally insignificant if we don't have an understanding of where that came from and how collectively we've got to come together and decide and choreograph the country we want. As a team, the University of Kansas, we actually voted at the Texas Relays whether we split the team so some of the team members could stay in the hotel with the swimming pool. We stayed together, stayed in military barracks. Coca-Cola was going to utilize me in a commercial, 1988. Came back and said the demographics say if the youngest to the eldest Native American was drinking Coca-Cola, there will never be enough Native Americans drinking Coca-Cola to merit using a Native American in a commercial. So we'll have a Native American theme. And they started putting on the side of Coca-Cola machines in Washington, D.C., the Redskins logo. I've addressed the Washington Redskins issue 5 times in the past 10 years. I've been spit upon. I'll use the word. I've been called prairie nigger. Simply because I said the Redskin logo does not honor me. Nowhere in our nation's capital, if we're going to come together, if we're going to heal, should we allow a football team named Redskin? But corporate money, sports money, the only downfall of our beautiful free enterprise system is profit at all cost. Other countries are learning. I'm going to close by saying this. America was the promised land for European white immigrants. I say it's still the promised land. But it's up to us if we want to make it the promised land for all of its citizens. For all of the immigrants, the new immigrants, the immigrants of the past, the immigrants of the future, and yes, we need to make it the promised land for the immigrants. We need to make it a promised land for the ancestors of slaves. We need to make it the promised land for the people, the First Nations people, the indigenous people. So the topic, I thank the School of Business. I thank the Athletic Department. I thank you for coming because we are great enough to come together and collectively choreograph our journey into the horizon of the future.
That's Billy Mills, who won the gold medal at the 1964 Olympics. He spoke at the Power of Sport Symposium at the University of Kansas on February 2, 2017. Tamika Dixon was part of the inaugural class of the WNBA, where she played 13 seasons following a successful KU basketball career playing under Coach Marion Washington.
You know, it's funny because I'm an East Coast kid, you know, coming to the Midwest, and I heard every Dorothy and Toto joke known to man before coming here. But the experience for me obviously was a little bit different. Than Billy. Coming in here, Marion Washington was the head coach here. Phenomenal coach and phenomenal woman, also an African American. So she helped shape me right away. When you think about race in sports and the power of sports, it was huge coming here and playing for an African American coach for me. At that time, there was not very many. The only other major one I can think of is like a Coach Vivian Stringer. Other than her, Marion Washington was it. And she was a powerful presence. You know, her nickname was the Dean of Big A Coaches. She became that for Big 12 as well. So being a player coming in and playing under her tutelage was an honor for me. she helped to break down those barriers. And as a player playing under her, we really didn't know what she dealt with on a day-to-day basis. She kept a lot of that from us. But we were a sisterhood. You know, we had women from all races and different backgrounds coming together. We were a sisterhood. And that's the great thing about sports, is it isolates you in a sense, because obviously you become sisters with the people that you play with, or brothers with your teammates if it's a male. And you kind of get shielded from a lot of things on the outside, but not really. But you're with your teammates so much that becomes your family. And then you also have an opportunity to learn other cultures. And, you know, I can share a story, a brief story. Like I said, I came from the East Coast. I'm from New Jersey. My roommate, Shelly Canada, was from Oklahoma. So a Jersey kid and an Oklahoma kid together. And I remember visiting with her family my freshman year. She asked me, invited me to come down for Thanksgiving. We had a day or two off. So I go down to share Thanksgiving with her family. And I promise you, it was one other African-American guy in that town. It was her sister's boyfriend. We were the only two. But it was culture shock for me, because I had never experienced that. So, you know, sports has a way of intertwining cultures, and you get an opportunity to learn from other people. And, I mean, Shelly and I are sisters, you know what I mean? So, like I said, sports just has a way of intertwining things like that.
Sure. Very good. How about the going into the WNBA, mm-hmm. and the experience of that? What is your reflection on the status of the league today? I mean, you guys were out there breaking the barriers, mm-hmm. but at the same time, the league today the pay is miserable compared to the men.
Right.
And then, of course, just a reflection maybe on one of the great things that I think that people forget is. You know, we've been in the age of Kaepernick, if you will, for over this course of the year. But the women in the summer, mm-hmm. with wearing the shirts, mm-hmm. They kept that protest going, if you will.
Absolutely.
And kept it in the limelight. And I don't think they get enough credit. So those are two very different questions. But any thoughts on either one of those?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we did break barriers coming into the WNBA. No one knew what to expect. Mm-hmm. I remember as a senior playing here, at the time I had an opportunity. There was two professional leagues, which a lot of people don't know. There was the ABA, which is the American Basketball Association, who was paying was paying six figures immediately. And then there was the WNBA, who had the backing of the NBA. So I had an opportunity to choose which league I wanted to play for, and did I want to go for the immediate money, or did I want to go for with the WNBA, who I knew and I felt was going to be around for a number of years. I actually chose the WNBA with coaches' help. I was able to garner some endorsements and things like that to help with the pay of the WNBA at the time, and it was on a pay scale. Where you were drafted was what you got. So it was a little different, but we broke a lot of barriers. You know, the fans came out and supported, but it is it's a constant struggle, you know, trying to continue to get people out and supporting women's sports. And, you know, I'm proud of where the league has come. Mm-hmm. And how far they've come. And I see the women, you know, you have to use your platform to take a stand, right. Either way. And they've been doing that this summer, and it's continuing to grow.
Yeah, very good.
All right, this question is for Tamika. My name is Tamara Gibson. I'm an academic counselor here with women's basketball and soccer. And there are several examples that we can give of female athletes kind of speaking out against injustice. For example, you guys mentioned it before, the WNBA players wearing the Black Lives Matter T-shirts, as well as Serena Williams kind of writing an open letter about some of the activities that we saw in 2016. It didn't get a lot of buzz and a lot of support. My question to you is, do you feel that female athletes, their activism and their efforts are overshadowed by their male counterparts? And if so, why?
It's a good question. It just depends. I think any platform that you have, you need to use it. Whether that's you playing on a women's sports team or a men's sports team, believe me, people are watching. So even though you may not garner as much attention doing that, you have to use your voice and you have to use your platform to do that. I remember when I was here, we were pretty good. We were just about to crack the top 10. And we used to have a campaign called Fill a Field House, where we tried to bring in as many student athletes to come to our games and things like that. And I remember it being such a big deal that the young lady who was working for the sports information department, her name was Chrissy Causey at the time, my girl, she came and asked me without writing an open letter to the fans about coming out to the game. And so I did that. And we actually sold the field house out. I don't know how many students actually read that open letter that I wrote, but it was an awesome experience for me to be able to voice my opinion, because at the time the men's team was top five, obviously, but we were just about to crack the top 10, so we're pretty good too. And I felt at the time, you know, that we needed to be recognized for those accomplishments. So yeah, anytime you have a platform, I would say, even though you feel like it's minimized because it's coming from a woman's perspective, you have to use that platform and you have to get out there and do what you gotta do. That's the only way that it's gonna change things and move the needle.
Hi, good evening. My question revolves around the idea that sports are political, right? And I would like to hear from both of you if possible. What do you say to people when they say to you, stick to sports? Don't talk about politics, just stick to sports.
There are many, many ways I can respond. I'm gonna respond if it's a Native American issue, but I think it applies to sport. When it comes to a Native American issue that we faced, it takes political activism to change a particular law, to change a particular perception. So it's not politics. I'll just say that it's not politics here. The very shallow response is keep out of politics. But it takes, to have a major change, it takes taking the anger, it takes taking the perceptions that everything's fine in America, trying to understand them, and put them into basic policy change, and that calls in many ways changing the Constitution, Supreme Court change, etc. So I will just say, beyond politics, let's just talk about what's happening. And I'll just say, what's political about it? It takes political activism to change. Then let's get back to what change has to occur. So we've got to go beyond the thought, let's talk sport instead of politics. We need to talk choreographing a journey into the horizon of our future collectively, and what change needs to occur.
That's KU and Olympic track star Billy Mills speaking at the University of Kansas Power of Sports Symposium, February 2nd, 2017. We also heard from WNBA and KU basketball star Tamika Dixon. Join us next week as KPR presents the Power of Sport keynote speaker, Dr. Harry Edwards. Earlier this hour, filmmaker Kevin Wilmot on legendary basketball coach John McClendon. Again, his film on McClendon's life and legacy is showing on KCPT Monday, March 13th, Thursday, March 16th, and Saturday, March 18th. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.